Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
There is a place that is spoken about only in whispers. A dark area that spawns the beginnings of urban legends. A place where anything can happen, and usually does. During the light of day, it hides just outside of view. But when the sun goes down, spirits, creatures of the night, roam free, and things do go bump in the night. It is in every state and every country, and there is no escaping it, no matter how safe you feel behind your locked doors and latched windows. So we invite you to turn down the lights and turn up your radio while we join Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis, your hosts, on a journey into the darkness on the edge of town.
Hello and welcome. You're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. I'm Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. We're shaking things up a little bit this week, Tim.
I see this. Yeah.
Just a little bit. Now, here, why would we shake things up? I'll explain why we're going to shake things up. Because there's not as much news being reported on supernatural elements during our current crisis. So we do have a couple of news stories to cover, but we've also got a guest that's going to join us. We're going to discuss Ethel Allen's Date with the Devil. Gail Sheldon, our guest. But first, Tim, let's jump into the handful of supernatural news stories. We've got a couple of doozies coming up. Where are we going to go off to first?
Well, we're headed right back to the Skinwalker Ranch, Dave. You know, a couple weeks ago, we were talking to Dr. Travis Taylor about the secret of Skinwalker Ranch. There's a story out there about a possible real UFO caught on video at Skinwalker Ranch during the History Channel's live feed out there.
Yeah. I heard about this.
Yeah. So the question remains, was a UFO spotted at Skinwalker Ranch in Utah? The History Channel promoted the Secret of Skinwalker Ranch series with a 12-hour live stream from the iconic ranch, which picked up some interesting lights. The new nonfiction series takes a closer look at the mysterious ranch where people have spotted UFO for decades, along with paranormal activity and some weird cattle accidents. While not everybody believes in the paranormal or aliens, just about everybody can agree that there is some odd energy at Skinwalker Ranch. The History Channel's 12-hour live stream was mostly uneventful. With that being said, there is a weird moment at the 3-hour, 7-minute, and 20-second mark. A light comes into the frame, and then in the upper right-hand corner, one can easily see some green triangular bits of light. While this is almost positively light activity from a security Jeep, there are people who believe that it may have actually been a UFO sighting. For now, this seems very doubtful, and people could be playing April Fool's jokes, according to this. Dr. Travis Taylor is leading the Secret of Skinwalker Ranch. He's an astrophysicist with PhDs in quantum physics and aerospace engineering, along with designing. He also happens to work for the Department of Defense and writes science fiction novels in his free time. Well, he did not want to give too much away about the series. He did say, "You'll see evidence we acquired that is scientifically verifiable. You're going to be blown away because I was. I'm amazed to this day and still have a hard time believing what I saw." Dr. Taylor saw some stuff on a daily basis during his 4-month stay at Skinwalker Ranch, and he had this to say. "What I saw was within our universe, so to me, I'd say it's normal. I'd say something that we just don't understand and don't know what it is. Absolutely, without a doubt, we have scientific instruments that detected and measured multiple witnesses see multiple cameras and multiple occasions phenomena that cannot be explained by human technology. They were beyond the physics of mankind. It doesn't mean that it can't be explained by a better or future understanding of physics, but it does mean we can't explain it with human technology. It will be interesting to see what the Secret of Skinwalker Ranch has uncovered. The show just premiered earlier this past week, and so far, the alien and paranormal enthusiasts seem to be enjoying it. Along with the UFO sightings, there are people who believe there are portals to other dimensions on the property, which is currently owned by real estate mogul Brandon Fugel. The land was allegedly cursed by the Navajos and apparently has a lot of weird stuff going on there. Well, Dr. Travis Taylor said he wasn't scared at any time during his 4 months there. He also says he would not allow his family on the property, which is an interesting fact. The History Channel probably did not find evidence of UFOs in their 12-hour live stream, but that doesn't mean that there isn't something strange going on there in terms of energy. The Secret of Skinwalker Ranch has already premiered and airs every Tuesday night starting at 10 p.m. on the History Channel. That's 10 p.m. Eastern. You can also stream the series on Hulu after it airs on the network. You can also check out the live stream from Monday night on the History Channel YouTube channel.
Actually have on today's episode, I've got a link to the Skinwalker Ranch live stream video and denote. So this entire article plus that video is a link on today's show. So you can actually click it, go there to the 3-hour, 7-minute and 20-second mark to watch for this phenomenon. Let us know what you think about it as well. I don't know. It looks pretty weird. It is a strange piece of video evidence.
Yeah, most definitely. Most definitely.
All right. Where are we off to next, my good sir?
We're going to Tunisia, Dave. Don't say I didn't warn you. Don't say I didn't warn you. Don't say.
Doom. Is that what I hear in the background?
Doom. Yeah. You people and your AI, you think robots make everything easy.
Yeah, they do, Tim. It's proven. It's a proven fact of science.
Proven fact that science will eventually get you in trouble. Just saying.
Wow.
We go to Tunisia, Dave, where the AI police state is ramping up. Just saying. Tunisia has deployed a police robot on lockdown patrol, Dave. Sooner or later, they'll be walking on our bones!
Doom. Yeah? What's going on? What are you twisting to believe that this is the end of the world as we know it?
A police robot has been deployed to patrol areas of Tunisia's capital, Tunis, to ensure that people are observing coronavirus lockdown. It's begun, Dave. It's begun. Just saying. If it spies anyone walking in the largely deserted streets, it approaches them and asks them why they are out. Then it stuns them and then shoots them in the back of the head and walks on their decaying body.
Wow, that, what?
No, I might have gone a little far with it, but it does ask them why they're out. They must then show their ID and other papers to the robot's camera so officers controlling it can check them. This is the second week of a nationwide lockdown to contain the virus, which has killed 14 people there. Everyone must stay in their homes, but people are allowed out for medical reasons or to purchase necessities. The North African nation currently has 436 people being treated for COVID-19, the respiratory illness caused by coronavirus. How does this robot work, you may ask, Dave? Well, it simply shocks you, then you fall to the ground, and then it puts a gun to the back of your head, it blows your brains out, and then, of course, it rolls right over your dead bones. Okay, maybe I made that
again,
part
that
up.
Seems like a stretch. Yeah, you know, that does seem like a stretch.
But it will have that capability eventually. How does the robot really work? Well, it is not clear how many of the Tunisian-built surveillance robots called P-Guards or PG-Ards, I think it's P-Guards, have been deployed by the Interior Ministry. The manufacturer, Innova Robotics, told the BBC it was a confidential matter. Of course it is. It also refused to reveal the price tag. A four-wheel...
You know, Tim, I'm just saying you might be overreacting. We need to give a positive face to these law enforcement robots.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And
let's just smile.
We actually have audio from one of them.
Oh, we do?
My friends call me Murphy. You call me...
That's not positive, Dave.
That is. His name is Murphy. That's what his friends, but the people can call him RoboCop, Tim. He's just out policing the area, keeping us safe from harm. We've needed this for a long time, Tim.
Didn't RoboCop shoot a guy in the nuts?
Only because he had it coming to him.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Maybe had it coming and shot in the nuts is not the most apropos pair of sentences I've ever put together, but yes.
Mm-hmm. A four-wheeled P-Guard has a thermal imaging camera and LIDAR, light detection and ranging technology, which works like radar but uses light instead of radio waves. The Interior Ministry posted a video on Facebook about its futuristic mission to impose the restrictions not long after the lockdown started.
Thank you, RoboCop.
God, no. Some welcomed the move, while others said the robot moved too slowly to be effective. Thank you, Jesus. But several videos have since appeared on social media showing people being stopped by a P-Guard. In one, a man who is asked if he knows there is an ongoing lockdown explains that he wants to buy cigarettes. The robot replies, "Okay, buy your tobacco, but be quick and go home." How creepy. Before coronavirus swept the world, Enova's clients were largely private firms. Its chief sales officer, Radouhane Ben Farhat, told the person who wrote this article. The firm, which has its headquarters in the coastal city of Sousse, also produces a healthcare robot, he said. It can give a preliminary visual diagnosis.
Yeah.
And use its sensors to measure certain things, and one will soon be working at a hospital in Tunis. This would help minimize physical contact between medics and patients with COVID-19, Mr. Farhat said. Robotic technology and artificial intelligence are increasingly being used during these exceptional times, as been seen by in China. Which use disinfecting robots and thermal camera-equipped drones, amongst other gadgets, to fight coronavirus and also to exterminate anyone who was found on the street and then thrown in big body heaps and then set on fire.
Seems like, again, that seems like a stretch, especially when we've got this kind of quote from RoboCop himself, Tim.
Okay.
Any special message for all the kids watching at home?
Stay out of trouble.
That's a pretty good bit of advice for all the kids at home.
Propaganda.
Stay out of trouble.
Propaganda. Oh, wow. Just saying. I don't know. Yeah. That's all I got.
Really? That's all?
I'm trying to keep it positive in a negative world, Dave.
Thank you for your cooperation.
Yeah, that's all he has to say. Thank you for your cooperation, Tim.
Mm-hmm. That's all I can do until they come along to crunch my bones into dust. And
ow.
Yeah.
I don't know what life is like to be so negative and also worried as you are, Tim. That's got to be wearing.
Do you need a hug, buddy? I might have
you
a small a arsenal waiting for the sumbitches when they come my way. I'm just saying.
Listening, Tim. Alexa's listening. She's going to alert them that you said that.
I don't have one of them at my house.
I do, and it's always listening.
Well, listen to this, Alexa. I got a couple of slugs waiting for you, you some bitch.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now it knows where you're at, too, Tib. Good job.
Doesn't know where I'm at.
It does. He can be found at 3.
Hey, why are you such a snitch? Snitches get stitches.
Could you sound a little more whiny? Hey, why are you such a snitch? That was very, very exit stage left. Who was that? The pink lion guy. I can't even think of his name right now.
Snagglepuss.
Yeah, Snagglepuss. That was very Snagglepuss of you. Hey, why are you such a snitch? I didn't go, hey,
why are you such a snitch? I didn't do it that way. I didn't go, why are you such a snitch? Snitches get stitches even. I didn't say it like that.
That's how I heard it. I'm not going to lie. That's exactly how I heard it.
That's not how I said it.
Snitches get stitches even.
I didn't say it like that.
Don't say like that. All right. Where are we up to next? Now that you're totally terrifying yourself with the concept of nothing but loving robotic police officers there to protect and keep us safe, Tim.
They're not keeping us safe, Dave. The walls are closing in, buddy. Just saying. Mm. Just saying. Yorkshire Ghost Hunters. That's where we're going to Yorkshire, Dave, where the Ghost Hunters are hitting back at trolls in Lockdown Row for visiting the Poltergeist House. I don't know what that thing means, but let's read into it and find out. A married ghost hunting couple from South Yorkshire have hit back at online trolls who are trying to sabotage their livelihoods by claiming the pair are breaking coronavirus lockdown rules. Now I know what it means. I guess they like their freedom. Lindsay and Lee Steer from Rotherham are behind Ghosts of Britain, which investigates spooky and paranormal sightings across the country. The pair operate from their base at the Haunted Objects Museum and Poltergeist House in Broad Street, Rotherham.
They refer to it as their mom's basement, but whatever, can put whatever title they want to on it.
That's true. It's a nice basement, though, and they've got cable and all that other stuff. And regularly live stream from, they've got internet, too, and regularly live stream from the building to hundreds of thousands of their fans on Facebook. However, Mrs. Steer says the couple have been visited by police after anonymous tip-offs claim the pair have been flouting government advice by going about their day-to-day lives. She wants to make it clear that they are doing nothing wrong by traveling to and from the Poltergeist House. Well, yeah, you are. The 50-year-old said, they're 50 and living in the basement. Police knocked on our door on Monday because someone anonymously reported us. I explained that this is our job, and the police officer just put her head in her hands, which I don't blame her. We earn a living from this, and it pays
us. Is it considered an essential job, though?
No, it's not. It's really not. We earn a living from this, and it pays our bills. It's a huge business, and we choose to go to our museum, which we can do because we have no contact with anyone else. We can drive to the museum, lock ourselves in, and have no contact with anyone else, but a small minority of people in the paranormal world think it's wrong. The government has said we can do that. Even though we're not key workers, anyone can do it. This is what the quote is. Mr. Steer, who's 34 years old and evidently wiser than the rest of us, has allegedly received death threats online, and the pair said they regularly have to deflect a barrage of abuse from cyberbullies. Welcome to the internet, buddy.
Doom, 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 doom. Cyberbullies, no?
Yeah, well, I like it. Yeah, I say go with it. Mrs. Steer said, the bigger the group, the harder people will come at you to bring you down. No matter what you do, you're always in the wrong, and they're constantly trying to sabotage us. Oh, it kind of sounds like the Whitney and Bobby story, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Bobby, go get me some crap. We can't work from home because our house isn't haunted and we never lie and we're not fake. We get scared to go out, and Lee has even had death threats because of this. Well, because they're afraid you're spreading a virus. That's why.
Really? Death threats? That seems overboard again.
Well, the pair said people have questioned why they do not claim benefits, but Mrs. Steer says she doesn't want to while they can carry on making an income by commuting to the Poltergeist House. She said, me and Lee can, I want to say it in a Southern accent, but I know they're not from the South.
They might be from the Southern part of that area.
That's right. Me and Lee can still work, so why should we try to claim when we don't need to? I don't know. That little bit of money is better off going to someone else. She went on to say, we don't need to claim benefits yet. A lot of other people have lost their jobs and are in financial difficulty, but we can carry on working. The couple who got married in October of last year say their online following on Ghosts of Britain and another connected site means they have 500,000 online fans worldwide, which they say is the biggest ghost hunter following in Europe.
Hmm. Interesting.
They live stream on Facebook every day and earn money through Facebook Stars, with the couples recently deciding to donate a huge quantity of goodies to frontline workers fighting to curb the spread of coronavirus. Well, that's good. At least they're taking some of that and donating it.
That's true.
Mrs. Steer said, we wanted to give something back to key workers, so we decided to donate all the stars we raised on Saturday to NHS staff over in England and other key workers. It came to over 300 pounds in money, and I bought lots of chocolate, biscuits, crisps, and sweets, all the goodies, and I took some to the police, who were overwhelmed, and I wanted to donate the rest to the NHS. These idiots take it upon themselves to say we are profiteering from this, but every single penny we made from Saturday went to key workers. It doesn't matter, though, because we still get abuse, and that is what we're up against. I don't know. It depends. How many people are you putting?
They just set loose the RoboCop in that area. Nobody will have to worry about it.
Well, yeah, you put the Terminator after them, and by gosh, nobody, that's all done.
Oh, my gosh, by golly.
You know, I don't know. In this case, how many people are you truly exposing by what you're doing? If you're not exposing anybody by what you're doing, then I guess, yeah, if it's two less people off the government dole, then fine. Make your money.
Are they right? And they're not in buildings where there's a bunch of people. They're kind of by themselves, right?
It sounds like it.
Yeah. I don't know. I understand. It's a scary time, though. People are nervous. I'm nervous. You're nervous. You're worried about robot uprisings during all of this.
I am. It's going to come down.
That's not what we should be worried about, though. What we should be worried about is alien infestation, Tim.
Alien infestation?
Read your next story. Tell me I'm wrong.
All right. It says here that alien life form or venom symbiote. Shocking video of squirming black goo has the internet baffled. Really, this is crazy. This is what we're concerned about in these times?
Watch this video, and you tell me you're not confused and confounded by it. But go ahead, read the story.
If a global pandemic wasn't enough, it seems like we have to deal with a new threat, one that doesn't look like it belongs to our planet, it says in this story. As of now, 2020 couldn't get any worse. It appears that the venom symbiote or an alien life form has arrived on Earth. Well, at least that's what the internet is saying. The internet is saying, Dave, that's proper English.
All of them? All of the internets?
All of the internets. All of them, Dave. All of them. After a video was shared on the web showing a strange, gooey, black, sludge-like substance... That's all of my English there. Twitter user at Sunny Arcade posted the video on Twitter asking if anyone could identify what the strange moving substance was, and the clip instantly went viral, garnering close to 15 million views, 25,000 retweets, and 100,000 likes.
A partridge in a pear tree.
Exactly. While some jokingly argued that the video footage is the first actual evidence of alien life on Earth, others pointed out similarities to the Venom symbiote of the Spider-Man comics and movies, which led Venom to start trending on social media. One second here. This thing keeps moving on me. It led to Venom to start trending on the social media platform. The writhing mass of black glue. The writhing mass of black goo. Words is hard, Dave. Bears a striking resemblance to the native form of the Marvel character, which Tom Hardy famously played in the titular 2018 film. I said titular, Dave. Titular.
Come on, Tim. This is a family show. Keep it clean.
I am. The unidentified substance also contracts and pulls itself back together when an individual runs a jagged saw through the squirming matter. Are you kidding me? 3 days into April and we suddenly got venom on our effing hands? I can't take this year anymore, wrote one user, while another commented, it's official. Aliens are real. That's what they said in the comment. So far, nobody really has a clue as to what this thing is for sure. There may be a plausible scientific theory behind it. Some are claiming that the black goo is simply a bootlace worm or a cluster of them. Some of the longest animals that can grow up to 55 meters long, bootlace worms are known to secrete a slimy mucus containing a highly powerful neurotoxin as self-defense against natural predators, as demonstrated in the video, if you do get a chance to take a look at it. The toxic venom, pun intended, has proven to be potent enough to kill crabs and cockroaches. Fortunately, it's much less effective in the cells of mammals like us, so we have nothing to worry about. So, if it is these worms, you're in luck, you're safe. If it's venom, you're in luck, you're screwed.
It's crazy, right? I mean, look at it. Are you watching that video at all?
No, but I can. If here, let me pop it on here.
Let's Please see. Do, yeah.
Okay,
I'm including that link as well on today's episode, folks. So you'll have the link to the Skinwalker video, the 11-hour live stream they did. You could go to the 3-hour, 7-minute, and 20-second mark to see the weird lights in the sky. I'm also including this video. It'll be the alien venom video, and I'll have a link up for that. But it's bizarre, dude. As a comic book fan, you got to kind of love this.
I watched it. It does kind of look more like worms than anything else, but that's just me. I'm sitting here with a shotgun right now waiting for a police robot to burst through the studio door. So, you know.
Did you hear that?
What?
Doom, 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 doom.
Don't do that.
Doom, 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 doom. I'm Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. Today we have an interesting episode lined up. This is one of those genre-bending episodes, Tim, that kind of crosses between true crime and the paranormal. And I know that's kind of how we started our True Crime Tuesday programs, right? Kind of delving into some of these strange, unusual crimes and what paranormal elements could be brought into it.
Mm-hmm.
Our guest today is Gail Sheldon. The name of the book that she has written and co-author with Gloria Falco is Ethel Allen's Date with the Devil. Gail Sheldon, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Well, you're welcome.
This is a fascinating story. Before we get into the details of this story, I'm more curious about how you and Gloria came to this story. How did you both find out about it, and what made you decide that you wanted to dig a little deeper into this tale?
Well, both of us joined the same paranormal club. We didn't know each other previous to this. And it was pretty sad how all the people from, you know, that spoke about Ethel Allen, you know, she was a prostitute, and it was like she almost deserved it, or she didn't deserve to have her case, you know,
really kind of examined very well.
Right, because she, you know, because of her situation in life. So it was just, you know, very sad. So I think that's what how the two of us got together on this.
What a bizarre story on this case. So you investigate the crime and the story itself, and then actually take it into the paranormal realm. So let's back it up a little bit and introduce us. Who is Ethel Allen? What can you tell us about her?
Well, she was a young woman, 5'3", about 100 pounds. She was born in 1916, and she died on or around November 18th or 19th in 1934 during the Prohibition. And she is said to be the ghost at Ashley's Restaurant in Rockledge, Florida.
Now, do we know much about her life leading up to this murder?
Unfortunately, no. I had a really hard time even trying to find any relatives. And actually, when I did come across a couple of them, they didn't know anything about the murder. So it was there was really not a lot of information. But the murder was very interesting, so we went with that.
All right. Well, take me through what we do know about this case.
All right. Well, It was said to be an unsolved murder, and she had a boyfriend named William Wilson who came to town on a vacation. And during the Prohibition time, they did have borders at the Guard of Florida, similar to today for the coronavirus. And they would not allow you to come in if you did not have money. And this fella had stolen a really cool 1934 Tudor Ford and just recently robbed a bank. So he had some money and a nice car, and they let him into Florida on his vacation with his family. And he came here, and obviously he must have stopped and seen Ethel at her place of business, and they got along real well. So that was the start
so
of
he
their
was
relationship.
There, he was there with his family?
He was. He had. They are not sure if it was his wife, but with a woman and a young child, yes.
Okay, well, that certainly adds a strange wrinkle. All right, so he... He is there. I mean, it's not unheard of that married people do that, but, you know, it's just it's certainly a different aspect of this. So they get along. And how long are they connected to one another? Was this just a one time paid gig, or was this an ongoing kind of relationship?
It must have been a relationship for a while, but not too long. There's no information on that anywhere that I could find. But it appears that he had asked her to marry him. So I'm assuming at least a week. But he was, like I said, a thief and a con man. And his name, William Wilson, really was not his real name. It was an alias.
Oh,
and he, okay. Yeah, so he tricked her into this relationship with him. But he's not the only suspect.
Okay. All right. Well, tell me about the murder itself and what we do know about her untimely death, and then we'll kind of re-examine some of the suspects in this case. But
okay,
yeah, how was she discovered, and do they know about approximately how long she was dead at that point?
Well, they figured it was 1 or 2 days because they didn't know the last time she was seen alive, and it was back in the day they used to really put a lot of graphic information in the newspapers. So we had a pretty good indication of what happened to her. Her throat was cut. She was stabbed in the forehead at the base of her skull. Her right side of her face was crushed and battered. Her upper teeth were broken out and part of her lower jaw was missing.
Oh my
gosh. Someone tried to sever one of her legs, and it was almost detached from her body, and she was also burnt in an attempt to hide evidence of her identity.
Holy cow!
Yes, it was quite a horrific murder, especially for the time.
Well, at any time. I mean, that's horrific for back then, but boy, just in the annals of criminology and murder, they would all out on this poor woman.
Right. Yeah, she got it
now,
all.
So they thought she'd been dead for a day or two at this point when they came upon her. Where were her remains found?
Well, she actually was quite a distance from where she was last seen. Probably, I'm going to guess, around 20 miles or so at the end of O'Galley, Florida, which really is Melbourne now. But back in the day, it was O'Galley, Florida. And she was right on the riverbank of the Indian River estuary. And some fellow truckers, I guess, from Alabama saw some buzzards flying. And they thought, wow, we're going to go see something cool dead. Maybe it'll be a crocodile or, you know, they didn't know what they were going to see. And they went over there, and lo and behold, there was Ethel laying on a rock right at the edge of the river.
Now, you said that this was a time where this wasn't commonplace, these type of crimes. And, you know, this was what, Broward County, is that right? Or Brevard County? Sorry, Brevard County.
Brevard.
Right? Brevard. Brevard, I'm sorry. I'm Minnesotan, mm-hmm, it's right. Brevard to us, but okay, Brevard County. So it really was kind of a high shock factor. What was the area like during that time?
It was very touristy for, even though they didn't have air conditioning and mosquito spray like they do No, it was actually rather touristy down here. So we had the Cocoa Beach. People actually built a causeway to get over there, or they had boats, paddle boats that would take you on tours. There was the fishing was awesome. So it was heavily into the tourism industry. And of course,
wow, that could make it even harder to try to figure out and pinpoint exactly who might be the perpetrator. If she's a lady of the night and this is a high level touristy attraction area and lots of people coming and going through there, and certainly people looking to fill their nights with the attention of a lady, I would guess that would make this even harder. Now, with all the destruction you said that was done to her body, could you slowly go through some of that list again of exactly what happened to her? I mean, physically, that they could tell?
Right. Well, her throat was cut. And okay. The reason I don't think she was in the water for very long was because there was an extremely large amount of blood hanging off of her neck in large coagulations. Also, she was stabbed in the forehead at the base of the skull. Her right side of her face was crushed and battered, and her upper teeth were broken out, and part of her lower jaw was missing. So that, you know, that type of violence usually means somebody that knows you.
Could it be said, just out of curiosity, in examining that aspect, Gail, it's Florida. Could it be that... that some of this damage was due to alligator or you know, an animal attack of some sort?
That is a possibility, but I believe that it was done prior to her being placed on that rock. And not only for the blood, but if it were in the, you know, the blood wouldn't be there. That would be the soft tissue that fish or anything could, like, eat right away, and that'd be missing, you know. Well, I mean, my husband was a police officer, so I have seen some death scenes in correspondence to water, and this just didn't have that sound to it.
Okay.
So I don't believe she was in the water. I don't think that, you know, she could have been pecked on by the buzzards, but the buzzards flying overhead had not found her yet, so I don't believe that she was by animals.
And the alligators hadn't found her yet either.
Well, there's not as many. We do have them, but there's not as many in the estuary there because it's half fresh and half salt. And they prefer fresh. Crocodiles, gotcha. They don't care.
Right.
But I've always swam in that river, and we hardly ever saw alligators there.
You swam in that river?
Oh, yes, since the time I was young till now, even.
Wait a minute. Repeat your sentence to me. You used to swim in there, and you hardly ever saw alligators in there.
That's right, hardly ever.
Seeing them once would be one time too many for me. How do you, Gail, you've taken this episode onto a whole different course. What kind of daredevil are you in life that you're just, we only see them once in a while? That's the problem. They come up underneath, you don't know about it, and they get you in a death roll. I don't know if you know that's how these things work.
Of course I do. I watch swamp people.
Oh, my goodness.
Yep, we have always swam there, and I lived on an island. So we had the river on one side and the ocean on the other, and we always swam in the ocean, and we know Jaws lives there as well.
All right. You got me on that. Good grief. Okay. So we can pretty much rule out that this would have been done by animals. Maybe they're, you know, the jaw removed, maybe could have been an animal, but you got this, the slit throat, you've got the bashed in head, you've got quite a bit of violence to this woman. Who do we know is the last person that she reportedly had spent time with?
A night watchman at a local citrus plant was the last person to see her alive. And he actually gave an interview to several newspapers at the time. And of course, they had a little bit of conflicting information in them as well. So I put him on the suspect list immediately.
Yeah, right. I was going to say that.
I don't think he was ever on the suspect list of the sheriff, though.
Why do you think that was?
Because William Wilson, as eventually they find out who he really is, was a career criminal.
Okay. All right, so there,
you know, it's just like
the security guard is more like a good old. So the security guard's more like a good old boy. Oh, I doubt he's the guy when we've already got a guy who's got a criminal record.
Correct.
Okay. Just out of curiosity, did you ever discuss this case with your husband who worked in law enforcement, and what was his take on the security guard angle?
Oh, absolutely. He was right there. As soon as I said that was the last person that saw her alive, he goes, okay, let's find out more about him.
Right. So, yeah. So he was definitely a suspect that you thought was important. Who else do we kind of have to take a look at?
Those are the only two that I believe had anything to do with her disappearance. And also, before we go any farther, I'll tell you that the night watchman, his name was James Shealy, but I'll just call him the night watchman. He worked with her father, and this is in a really small area on Cocoa, right in downtown Cocoa. The citrus plant was there. His apartment was there. Her parents lived close, and also the bordello was extremely close. They were all within, I don't know, less than a quarter of a mile of all of the things together. So anyways, James Shealy, the night watchman, not only did he say that, you know, give her his interviews, he even said that she was jealous, which to me triggered my, are you kidding me? Why would she be jealous if she's going to go tell him that she's going to see her mother in a little place called Wachula, which was quite a distance away? Why would he say that she was jealous? She's going to marry someone else.
Right.
So that triggered, yeah, that was kind of odd to me right there. That reminds me of a lot of men that don't even actually live with a woman and fall in love with them, and then they start stalking them.
Well, and then the aspect that this seemed like such a personal attack, right?
Very personal.
Right. Talked to so many different investigators through the years on the show. That seemed like a personal vendetta attack almost, with the violence and the nature and the passion behind it, which would make the night watchman, who was friends with her father and had these connections, maybe even more viable in this case. Do we know, does his life ever go down a criminal pathway after this murder?
We know nothing about him. I was unable to find a thing about him, but I did find what he looked like from the son of the citrus plant. The son, he was only like 12 or so, I forgot how old he was, when he met James Shealy. Because he worked at his dad's citrus plant, and he said he was pudgy, and he thought he might have been a little bit middle-aged, but not anything to write home to mom about. So he was nothing special, so it wouldn't be the kind of, she was a good-looking woman, and of course, William Wilson was a good-looking man, and, you know, like one of those high-about-town guys where she, that she would have been more attracted to somebody a little more handsome, I'm assuming.
Gotcha. Wow. Well, but, you know, you can't even say that. Look, if that were the case, you know, I'm married to an extremely beautiful woman who people look at me and think, what? It's sometimes your personality is so charming and amazing. I don't want to toot my own horn here, but that could be the winning over aspect. But I don't know. We can't throw the baby out with the bathwater just assuming that, you know, well, looks wise, she could do better elsewhere. And people have fallen in love for other reasons besides looks, or so I've been told.
Right.
I don't know. I could be wrong on that.
The statement about him saying that she was jealous and she was actually going there to tell him that she was getting married. So that was like, that really doesn't add up. One plus one does not equal two at that point.
All right. I can, that math makes sense to me. All right. So let's go a little deeper then. So these are the main prospects in who might be the perpetrator. Continue on. Who else do we have to look at?
Well, that's it. There's only those two people that I could find. And I know when I went to the Historical Society and I was, before I had found out where the citrus plant was, because the paper never, it said Acme. And of course, there was never an Acme. But I went to the Historical Society and asked them, do you know, anything about these packing plants? And so he gave me a book with their stickers on it, you know, that they put on the end of their boxes. And there was an identical sticker to the Acme, and it said Delbora packing plant. And I thought, oh, wow, there's an actual name, you know, because obviously Acme is maybe somebody's name, but not anyone
right.
I know.
I
did find a Delbora, and I did call him and find out that he was the son, and he had a lot of information and pictures for me. So that was pretty interesting.
Okay. What did they think? Were you informing them of why you were so interested and fascinated in that specific person?
I did. And there was a fellow that had been there. He actually did write a book as well. Charlie
I apologize.
Carlson.
I think you moved your phone a little bit. Suddenly your microphone's a little muffled. I don't know if your finger has gone over a microphone or your chin or something. But okay.
All right. Yeah. So what they did say was Charlie Carlson. He passed in 2015. He was a famous novelist, and he's been on Travel Channel. I don't know if you know him, but he wrote a lot of weird things about Florida. But they said he had already been in there, and I was wasting my time because he was unable to find anything. So I thought, well, I guess they don't know me.
All right. So you get this information. But they were willing. They were forthcoming with the information, even though you thought that this relative might be a murderer.
Well, at the Historical Society, they gave me the information for Delbora, and Delbora had the packing plant. And,
So
James Shealy just worked there. He wasn't a relative or anything.
Okay.
But I did interview that fella, and he was very interesting. But then I actually, after I did the historical part,
right.
I had to step out for a minute and go to the paranormal to get a little more information to help me out. I've been interested in the paranormal. I've been in the paranormal since 2008, and I'm an actual dowser. I know a lot of people don't believe in dowsing, but I did it professionally for a water company, Well and Water, and I would come and mark your septic if it was never on an original map back in, you know, smaller towns and stuff. And I had a call one time from a city that said, we heard that you were the best dowser around, and could you come and douse our cemetery and tell us where unmarked graves were? And I was like, I can't do that. But they talked me into it, and I came there, and I fled all of the areas, which I was so shocked that this happened. I put flags up all around each one of the unmarked graves that my dowsing rods told me were there. And a couple of weeks later, they started digging out the backside of the hill. And sure enough, right where I had some of my flags, you could see a darkened spot down in the ground about 6 feet down. So I was like, oh, my gosh, if you could douse for dead people, what else can they do in the paranormal? So I've been dowsing ever since then.
So you found it. You found some of these spots that they were looking for.
Right. But that was just what got me into dowsing paranormally.
Okay.
But for Ethel Allen, what I did was I was at an actual investigation where the rumor was in town that she died at the restaurant, the Ashley's restaurant. So we were doing an actual paranormal investigation there. And I asked her, would you show me where you were buried, where you were murdered? And we went down the stairs, straight out the front door, and it pointed towards Coco, my rods. And I thought, what the heck? And it was a pole that just, I'll never forget it. It was almost as if someone was pulling me. And I looked down and I'm standing on a manhole cover and I went, oh, crap. Darn it.
Gotcha.
I thought maybe I had something, but that pole stuck in my mind. And a couple of weeks later, I told my husband, you are going to have to take me to Coco because you can't drive in Dallas at the same time.
So right. Yeah, that's got to be kind of hard.
Exactly. So he took me up there, and I started dowsing at the last place she was seen. The actual packing plant is no longer there. It's just a parking lot. And even the railroad tracks are gone there. So a lot of things have changed in the town. So I started there and asked if that was where she was murdered, and she said no. I said, well, can you show me where you're murdered? And about a block and a half away, she takes me to another parking lot. And I thought, well, what could be here? And I went to the Historical Society, and there was not one piece of evidence, nothing that told me what was in that parking lot. So when I was interviewing that Delbora fellow where his dad owned it, he said, oh, yeah, that was our parking. I asked him, I said, you don't happen to know what could have been in that parking lot there? He goes, oh, yeah, we owned that. We owned the... We had our garage there where we repaired all of our pieces of equipment, cars and stuff. He said it was just a wood garage. And he parked all the trucks there. And I asked him, I said, do you know if they had a burn barrel? He goes, absolutely. Because, you know, being a young fellow, he enjoyed throwing stuff in the burn barrel and burning it. So that was very interesting to me.
What did that tell you then? What information did you glean from that?
The night watchman worked at the packing plant, and his job was to actually, I didn't find out what his job was right at that time. I just assumed that people broke into the. I really didn't know why they needed a night watchman for the packing plant, but later on at another investigation, I had asked John Delbora, I said, why do you think they hired people? Did you guys have a lot of break-ins or something? And he said, oh, no, they had to keep the degreening room. They had, like, things lit in there, like gas that was lit to make the fruit ripen. And his job was to make sure that the light didn't go out. So very interesting. So
go ahead.
You're breaking up.
I said, go ahead.
Oh, so but that came from another investigation where we found out that right behind Delbora Packing Plant was the old Buick garage. And the Delbora Packing Plant bought that property just shortly after Ethel died. And the night watchman might have possibly worked there as well. And there was reports that somebody would light candles in there, a spirit. So I went, oh my gosh.
There were reports of spirits in this area as well then.
Oh yes, definitely. Definitely. Yes, there was all kinds. It's now, I think, like some kind of restaurant. But at the time, it was a warehouse where I went and went there about four or five times and did investigations. Very active with spirits. Very active.
Now, but tying back into this crime. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, getting back to that little spot where there was a burn barrel, I did mention that when her leg was almost detached, she was also burnt in an attempt to... hide her evidence. Now, that's not the kind of thing you don't just go and throw a match on a human being and they're not going to catch on fire. So having, you know, actual fire there was rather interesting as well. That put another little notch in James Shealy's cap for being the murderer, for me.
And, but he was never really truly examined, you said.
No, he was not. No, not that okay. I could find. I didn't find one thing. I did go to Sheriff Roy Roberts' home, and his grandson, his name was also Roy Roberts III, and he did have all a whole book full of memories from his father. And there were like pictures from the 30s, newspaper clippings, and some very interesting books that helped us get more information. So it was very, very, very interesting to just every time we moved along just a little farther, we'd find something more. It was pretty cool.
Now, as you're doing this, you start to employ more of the supernatural. Do you believe that you ever end up coming into contact with Ethel Allen?
Yes, we did. And, you know, it's kind of weird. If you've obviously been around spirits, you know that mostly they're in the bathroom. Somebody says, oh, they died here, whatever. And they don't go in out of the house. They usually stay in that particular area. Sometimes even in just a room, rather long, just a house. But Ethel has been, she's the type of spirit that can travel. She will go all the way to Georgiana Cemetery where she is buried. And that's actually several miles away across the water from where she was murdered. She actually followed a friend of mine home, and she has been out trying to get somebody to help her. She is the type of spirit that will just follow you, and she will come across an EVP in a second.
Well, let's. I want to get into the paranormal aspect of this story. We have to take a quick break. We'll come back. We've got more as we examine Ethel Allen's date with the devil. Gail Sheldon, our guest, right here on Darkness Radio.
You know, in these turbulent times, we all need a break now and then, especially now that we're all kind of forced together in kind of the same space while we're all being quarantined, and especially now that we're all being forced to shelter in place. But why not keep your brain active while you relax? That's why I love the fun puzzle game Best Fiends. It's an oasis of fun that you can take with you anywhere, especially anywhere around the house, away from people, away from maybe the people you're quarantining with, just to get away from people. It's a great, great thing when you need some me time, just to get away from the regular world. Best Fiends is a fun escape from the everyday of just the regular world and regular problems. And believe me, we all have had some regular problems lately. There are thousands of fun challenges and tons of cute characters to collect along the way. And I tell you, I've been having more and more fun with Best Fiends, especially since we've all been cooped up lately. I've been getting more and more into the game. It is a great escape. I tell you, folks, I've been using different strategies, too, to solve the different puzzles along the way since I've been playing Best Fiends. And I tell you, I've been recognizing patterns a lot easier and a lot better, too, since I've been playing Best Fiends. It's interesting how the way I solve puzzles and recognize patterns has changed since I've been playing Best Fiends. It's kind of interesting how my cognitive skills have changed a little bit since I've been playing Best Fiends. I kind of wish I had this game 30 years ago when I was back in high school and college and going through that learning process. I don't know. Maybe I would have been a little bit of a sharper bulb on the tree. Who knows? I really love the objective of the game and the different characters and getting through the different levels and seeing how high I can get through different levels. And I tell you, I really lose track of time playing Best Fiends because I get so into the game and I get competitive too. And I tell you, being hooked up through social media, I can keep track as well. I keep track with Dave. I keep track with the different friends and family that play with this game too, play with Best Fiends. And we all keep up with each other, and you can too. If you get into playing Best Fiends, it's real easy for you to get involved and keep up with us as well via social media. And you should. I'm telling you, we've all got a little bit more time on our hands than normal with being kind of shut in indoors with the whole COVID-19 and coronavirus thing. And Best Fiends is a great way to keep yourself sharp, challenge your brain, and also have a lot of fun at the same time. Best Fiends is a unique and exciting puzzle experience unlike any other of those puzzle games that are out there. Best Fiends also updates the game monthly, and I tell you, I've been getting new levels and events. It never gets old. I never sit down to Best Fiends and think, oh, it's the same thing over and over and over again. It's brand new. It seems like every time I sit down to play the game, which is great. Best Fiends treats the game like a service for their players. They're always coming up with something new and something random and exciting. And it seems like with every twist and turn, you're running into something really cool in the game that that just excites you and gets you wanting to play more and more. What's nice about Best Fiends is it doesn't require the internet for you to play. Maybe your internet's bogged down while you're at home. I know, you know, in our house, the internet's getting bogged down quite a bit. You don't need the internet to play right away. So you can log off the internet, you can play your Best Fiends, and you can hook back up to the internet if you want to connect with your players via social media. You don't need to worry about Wi-Fi access or using your cell data. You can log off for a while, you can play, then you can log back on if you want to connect to your other players. You don't necessarily need it though, which is great. You can collect tons of characters while you're playing the game, which is awesome. You're going to need your characters along the way because you need your different weapons along the way to help go after these different slugs and stuff. I know it sounds like I'm speaking a different language, but you'll find out when you get into the game. It's really, really exciting. Along with the puzzle solving, you have objectives as well. And so you kind of combine the two and you go on this journey along the way when you get to these different levels. And I'm telling you, I know I sound like I'm speaking gibberish, but it is really exciting. And there are new monthly theme challenges as well along the way when you play Best Fiends. And I'm telling you, get into the game. Come play the game along with Dave and I, because when you get there, you're going to be excited and you're going to get into this game. And it really gets addicting. It really gets fun. And you're going to have a great, great time with us as we're playing Best Fiends along with each other. Best Fiends has thousands of levels already, with new levels, events, and characters added every month. And it's hours of fun right at your fingertips. With over 100 million downloads and tons of five-star reviews, Best Fiends is a must-play. Now, here's what you can do to connect with the rest of us who are playing Best Fiends. It's real simple. You just download Best Fiends, that's friends without the R, Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. Once again, you just download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Go do it today. I'm telling you, you're going to have a once-in-a-lifetime game experience that's fun, it's addicting. It's going to suck you in, and you're going to have puzzle challenges there. You're going to have a fun experience and a fun adventure there. You're going to fall in love with these little characters, and you're just going to have a great experience all the way around. Again, you don't have to connect to the internet in order to do this game. You can play offline, and it's one of those things where you're just going to have a great time. And you can play along with your buddies, Dave and Tim. It's one of those great games where we can all play together, even though we're not in the same room. And by gosh, with this whole virus going around, we wouldn't want to be in the same room anyways. So do it right now. Go download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends.
Gail Sheldon and her partner Gloria Falco examining a cold case. A criminal cold case from the 1930s, trying to track down a killer, and began employing paranormal methodology to try to see if they could crack this case and get some more insight into it. Now, obviously, Gail, you were explaining to us in the first part of this, you know, the logical aspects of who the perpetrators might be in this case. You now are going to employ the paranormal to try to make communication. And talk us through what that was like for you. And you know, how quickly were you able to establish what you believe was true communication with her spirit?
Well, we had a couple more events where we had to use dowsing, which, you know, obviously we can't hear her voice with dowsing, and I can get yes or no replies. But We didn't know where she had the rock was where they found her body. It never was specifically mentioned, but it did say it was near O'Galley. So we went in that direction, and I dozed on the two-lane US 1, and it wanted me to go over to this little cemetery. And I was like, oh, cool, maybe they try to bury her in the cemetery or something, you know, in a way to hide the body. But after I got through there and dozed a couple of times, I realized they wanted me on the street behind there, which was Pineapple Avenue. So we came around in the vehicle and got on Pineapple Avenue, and she took me right to the rock. And, of course, it was somebody's yard. And so that was a very interesting part of the paranormal. And later on, we did find
information. So this energy led you right to where her body had been recovered?
Yes. And and to, you know, validate it, we eventually found information at the church where she was buried. The church is a little bit distance away from the actual cemetery, but it is affiliated with it. And they had an article in there, and it said right at the edge of O'Galley city limits. So it was, and that's where we were. And it said it was across the street from a trailer park. I was like, oh my gosh, I wonder where that used to be. So I called the historical site, and they said, oh, it's still there. So I didn't, sure enough, it was probably across the street, maybe 500 feet a little bit north, and that's where that rock was. And we went along all the way along the shoreline, and there was no other large rocks that would support a body. So that was another interesting paranormal event that we were able to validate. So those things worked.
Now, while you're there and you find this area, did you consider doing any kind of communication, like EVP, anything along those lines?
Yes, but we had to come back. So we had to get permission from the landowners to come back and do an investigation. And anytime you're doing an investigation outside, it's a little rough because you always get the external noises. But we did actually get an EVP that said, help me, in a female's voice. And we asked if it was Ethel Allen, and she said yes. So it was, and we just used a recorder. We didn't use a ghost box. But, you know, it was rather clear. I wouldn't say it was Class A, but it was Class B.
What information were you able to get from that?
Well, just that we knew where she was murdered. And I thought, you know, when a murderer dumps a body somewhere, it's usually something that they know. So perhaps this murderer stayed at the campground at one point. So that was led me into a direction to start investigating the campground to see if perhaps the, you know, James Shealy or William Wilson's name would come up on some kind of register or something.
Gotcha.
And
anything?
Also, unfortunately, I think it was a great granddaughter owned the campground now, and she did not keep any of the information. But I did find that they had a society section in the paper in Melbourne, and it did mention when people came to visit the area, and they did mention, you know, certain individuals, but they were probably a little more affluent than I'm sure that James and William Wilson probably stayed in the little cheaper type of hotel or motel. So unfortunately, that was not, it didn't get us anywhere, but it still gave us affirmation that we were on the right track. Because paranormally, it's hard. It's hard to do an investigation paranormally. So we went back to Ashley's. We did more investigations there. We did get some EVPs, nothing on camera. We did have IR camera and a heat sensor. We had all kinds of equipment, and we did get her voice. And she actually fell in love with one of our investigators and came home with him. And she went on several investigations with us. It was kind of interesting. but she left him when he got married.
The ghost actually fell in love with one of your investigators and ended up following
Correct.
Him home?
Yes. She talked to us on EVPs. When we were asking other spirits to speak with us, she would come across and was like, oh my gosh, what is Ethel doing here? So yeah, she followed us around for, I don't know, it was about 9 months. It was rather interesting.
And
I've never heard of a spirit falling in love with somebody.
She would clearly identify herself?
She certainly did.
Okay.
And she identified that she loved Chad as well.
When she would follow Chad, I mean, was there ever any physical contact? I'm not asking for sexual information, but
no.
I mean, was there ever any sense that he could feel she was there aside from just
Well, EVPs? Yes, he did feel she was there, but she never touched him or there was never any photograph of her or anything like that. Just EVPs.
Okay.
It was very interesting, though.
Yeah, no doubt. But she was it always the same voice that you were getting as well?
Always the same voice. Always the same voice every time. And I went to her where she was buried. Her brother had made her headstone. It was very personal. And she was there as well. And her voice came through. And I even have one that says, Gail, I'm following you. It was kind of a whisper, like, Gail, I'm following you. It was kind of interesting. But, she's very vocal. She has no problems following. And she's actually, there's reports of people at Ashley's restaurant that she has followed home. She's not the type of ghost that would try to hurt you or anything. She's just looking for help.
But multiple people have had this experience. Now, why do we believe she stays at that restaurant? What was her ties to that?
Well, Jack Allen, which has her last name, her two sisters worked there over the time. I did see where her sisters were mentioned in the census that they had worked as a waitress. And Jack Allen, gosh, his wife was, I forgot his, one of his ex-wives, rather. She was 101 years old, and I went and visited her. Quite a spunky lady. She said that that one of the sisters, she remembers one of the sisters that was definitely not Ethel, worked there at the restaurant when she was married to him. And of course, they weren't related. So she, a lot of people used to say she was related to the people at the restaurant. And also, the Ashley's restaurant now was called Jack's Tavern. And I think where her boyfriend, William Wilson, was living, it was probably less than a quarter mile from there. And I'm sure they frequented it. And they always said in the true crime magazines in the 40s that was where she was murdered. And the reason they probably said that, because that was the last of that restaurant still was operational. Well, all the other ones had already closed down after Prohibition. So I'm assuming that's probably why it was mentioned.
Was she ever forthcoming with information on who it was that murdered her?
She has told me that William Wilson murdered her. Because we, asked her point blank. Did William Wilson murder her? She did say yes at one point. But she also said that James Shealy was the one who actually did the murder. She thought that William Wilson took her there and left her there. Almost like it was his fault that she got murdered. So we had to clarify that a little bit by going through more than just one question. But I did start out with that one and I thought, oh, wow. But as we found out that she was answering us easily, and almost every EVP she would answer us, then we asked more in-depth questions and found out that she blamed him.
So you believe she thinks he hired her, he abandoned her, and then that's what led to her eventual murder?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. So she, and, well, I'm sure in death she probably knows he was a con man now too, you know?
Mm-hmm. No, no doubt.
Yeah.
So you uncover this and go forth. I mean, do you find out why is she staying here? What is she, why is she still haunting this area all these years later?
Because she always asks for help. She wants her murder solved. She wants it solved.
Well, you've given her that voice now, right? You've helped her. Do you feel that she has crossed over?
No, because James Shealy is still not being mentioned as her murderer. Only William Wilson.
Okay. So that's it. But you have given, and here you are on a radio show talking about this. So you are kind of giving that history. And is it surprising to you that now that you have uncovered it and are helping to spread that word, that her spirit still seems restless?
Yes. Oddly enough, you're not going to believe this, but people still go and look at the library, and they actually, if you go there and say, hey, I'm going to go to Ashley's restaurant, they actually have a file, so you don't go digging through their files, and they'll hand you four or five pages of information that was in the newspapers, but no place doesn't have any real information about who killed her. So all of the old myths stay alive.
And they,
well, I'm hoping
they
everybody
keep that
reads
out there.
It and goes, holy, yeah, and yeah. Goes, wow. Yeah, so all she right. Does need validation by more than just one person. So hopefully the book gets out there. And
have you ever had any kind of visitations where you could see her, either in dream visitation form or in spiritual visitation?
No, none. My husband has abilities, but I have just the minor abilities. I don't have a lot. And when I was younger, I had, I did see things that were going to happen, and they happened, but that has been a long time. So I don't know if what happened there, but I no longer have them.
Fascinating stuff. Your husband has abilities. While you were in the midst of doing this and working on this case, did he ever have the sense that she was around you, or did he ever see her or have any kind of communication?
No, and I'll tell you why. Because I've known my husband for 56 years, and I've been married to him for 52. And he has never, ever once told me that he had abilities when he spent his whole life with them. And one day I asked him, I said, how do you know that? It was something, I forgot, something on television. He goes, somebody tells me. I said, what? Somebody tells you? And he's like, yes, I've always had somebody that tells me things in my ear. I was like, a cop, he had somebody tell him in his ear, but he never told anyone. Never.
Fascinating stuff. Do you, now that you've uncovered this information and you've put this together with your co-author to investigate and try to put this answer out there, has law enforcement been willing to re-examine or take a look at any of this information? Has local media or anyone else been willing to reopen this case and examine it?
No. Uh-uh. Just people that are interested in the paranormal really hear about it. I have called the police department and asked, because murders never close, if they had any information about Bethel Island, and they did not. They went through all of their stuff. I had somebody that was really nice that went through all the paperwork, and there's nothing.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm.
Weird.
So I was like, wow, it isn't weird, because we did find out later on, once we started looking at William Wilson, who was obviously the one that everyone thought had killed her. As soon as we started looking at William Wilson more carefully, we found out why closed the case. The police did.
And why is that? Why would they close it down?
Well, William Wilson was quite the character. I had taken some notes so I wouldn't be so silly, but, he was actually killed in prison. he went to Los Angeles and he became the, let's see, what was his name? He changed his name to Graham. His real name was Willard Borton. And he had probably 20 aliases even before he came here. He was actually dubbed the Jersey Devil in the newspaper in the 1920s.
Oh, really? So he did have a shaky background. Okay.
He did, but it was all theft. And he was a con man and a thief. And he went over, and when he got to California, he changed his name to Graham, which is his mother's maiden name. So I'm sure if that lady was his wife, who was still with him at the time, he said, you know, I don't want anybody from my past looking me up, so we're going to change our name. You know, so she was with that. But he, when he got out there in California, he became a thief. And he actually was a very famous thief out there. And he stole from all of the stars of the time, like Clark Gable. And I don't know if everybody knows people from way back in the day, but certainly. Tyrone Powers, Gary Cooper, all of them. Yeah. So he was
kind of a celebrity cat burglar then.
He was, and because they didn't know that he had been, the sheriff, Roy Roberts, had found out what his name was, and he was looking for him, and so eventually when they did find him, they found that the Florida had a murder case open on him, so therefore, you know, he had all the press was just fawning over him, he was in all of the, magazines, shaking Tyrone Power's hand. He was, you know, and a handsome young man. So it was really, really big news. But then when they found out that he was there for murder in Florida, then all of a sudden the Robin Hood mentions are gone. And he actually, this is so odd, and we found out where he had been in school. We got his school records even from New Jersey when he was at some boys, like a boys town. And he was kept there. He had a moral surgery at age 16, which means similar to a lobotomy when he was 16 years old. I know.
That is,
so the guy,
well, certainly that gives you the, I would say that's a pretty, pretty high level suspect for this case then.
Absolutely. And he was he really did most everything without a gun, except for he did rob a bank, and they did not say whether he was brandishing a gun or not. But I did find an article in 1938 where he did brandish a gun at one of the movie star's wives when she was going to scream, and he said, "Don't scream," and he showed her the gun and then left. But he had so many aliases. Let's see, it was William Wilson, Harry Martin, James Willard, James Borton, Joe P. Walker, Willard Martin, Jay LaRue, you name it, he had that. And I actually found some of his relatives that do know about him, because he was in prison when they caught him for doing the robberies in California. I forgot what year that was. And I even took notes, darn it. But he even was, when he was arrested, he gave them a fake name, and he actually was put into Folsom Prison with a fake name.
Wow.
So I asked the,
imprisoned under a bat. So, that's crazy.
Yes. So when Ford eventually found out who he was, though, they did drop the charges of murder for their life sentence there for, I forgot what they called that thing, but anyway, sorry, I have dyslexia, so I have to forget words occasionally. But, they did, drop the charges, and they said if he was ever be let out, that they had to extradite him back to Florida, but he was killed in prison. over gotcha. Money, of course.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What a bizarre and twisted tale. Holy cow.
I know it.
That is so crazy. Ethel Allen's Date with the Devil. Our guest, certainly Gail Sheldon, has peeled back some of the veneer and exposed what sounds like the best suspect. And certainly knowing that his life went on to, you know, be a career criminal, and that he was something before then and continued on afterwards. It, you know, was there ever any other violent activity that we are able to prove that this was kind of part of his MO?
No, he only had two violent things happen to him that were ever documented. And one, I'm assuming you don't rob a bank with a pencil, but robbing the bank and then also robbing the one of the movie star's wives.
Okay. Great stuff. Thank you so much, Gail, for joining us and shedding a little light on this case that's been lost to time. We do have a link to the book on today's program, so you can find it very easily. Gail, please give our best to your co-author as well.
Okay, I will. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And thank you all. Hey, make sure you tune in again tomorrow. We have a very special show. Josh Gates joins us as we look into the curse of the Bermuda Triangle. That's right here on the best in paranormal talk radio. I'm Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. This is Darkness Radio.